The last superpower. I mean, with the nuclear buttons out of fashion and the Pentagon stuck in two frustrating battlefields, the last unambiguous power of a U.S. president just might be the constitutional authority to pardon. In the waning days of the Bush administration, the president's people are making a list and checking it more than twice. It's the power to transform naughty into nice. Pardon me? It's a takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, July 28th. President Bush faces an unprecedented rush of pardon requests in his waning days of office. Some famous felons are on that list. In Turkey, investigators are on the hunt for those responsible for two deadly bombings. Illegal immigration in Connecticut, two cities, two starkly different plans. And politics, a wrap on the race for president. Those stories in the rest of the day's news. In Istanbul, at least 16 people have been killed and more than 150 injured in two explosions in a busy Turkish residential district. Saban Karaka owns a shop nearby.
The first bomb went off at about 9:45. Stones flew up to my shop because the rubbish bin was made of concrete. The second blast happened 5 or 10 minutes later. All the windows of the shop were shattered. That explosion was much bigger.
So far, no group has claimed responsibility, but Turkish security services say the bombings look like the work of the Kurdish separatist group, the PKK. In Iraq, bomb attacks today in both Baghdad and the northern city of Kirkuk. In Baghdad, three female suicide bombers and a roadside attack took place in quick succession. At least 24 people were killed and more than 70 wounded. The bombings took place as tens of thousands of Shiite pilgrims flooded into the capital for an annual religious pilgrimage. In Kirkuk, Iraqi officials say a suicide bomber struck a Kurdish rally, killing 11, wounding 54.
Police in Knoxville, Tennessee, with the FBI, are searching for clues as to why a man opened fire at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church yesterday morning. Two adults died and seven others were wounded when a man with a shotgun began shooting during a production of a children's play. He's in custody and has been charged with first-degree murder. An out-of-control wildfire is still burning near an entrance to Yosemite National Park in California. The Telegraph fire has already consumed a dozen homes, and officials have ordered the evacuation of nearly 200 more homes.
As of today, customers of two banks, First National Bank of Nevada and California's First Heritage Bank, will be doing business as Mutual of Omaha Bank. The two banks were shut down by federal regulators Friday. The FDIC is assuring depositors they'll have complete access to their money. In politics, John McCain is holding a $1,000 plate luncheon at Seven Oaks in California this afternoon. He's expected to speak about offshore drilling tonight. Barack Obama is meeting today with his top economic advisors.
Oil at $123 a barrel in Asian trading, but maybe instability will push that higher. Nigerian instability, that's the news there. The Dow's at 11,370. The S&P opens at 1257. Who would you pardon if you had the power, the superpower, to pardon anybody unrestrictedly in the United States? Who would it be?
My ninth grade English teacher.
That's a story. We might do a whole double segment
we'll
on that.
Yes, later.
Indeed. But if you want to get to that, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your pardon story or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Who would you pardon or who should the president pardon in the waning days of the administration? Good morning, everybody. We're going to begin with a look back at a week that certainly was for the Obama campaign. And you can really hear it in this exuberant little montage on the Sunday political shows yesterday.
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama.
Obama.
Barack Obama.
Senator Obama.
Senator Barack Obama.
The candidate returned from a global tour to project his statesmanlike qualities, his experience on foreign policy, his ability to hold the attention of the media. But the McCain campaign wasn't buying it.
Barack Obama never held a single Senate hearing on Afghanistan. He hadn't been to Iraq in years. He voted against funding our troops.
Really, the struggle yesterday was for the McCain campaign to maintain some kind of profile in the face of the Obama juggernaut. And the campaign took pains to talk policy when Barack Obama wasn't giving speeches in front of adoring crowds of hundreds of thousands of people. He had specifics on Afghanistan for Tom Brokaw on NBC's Meet the Press.
Frankly, we need a more serious effort on the part of the Afghan government and President Karzai to get out of Kabul, to start the development process. We're going to need two additional brigades in Afghanistan, and we've got to work with Pakistan to get serious about these terrorist safe havens.
Obama talked policy. Senator McCain tried to maintain some sort of aggressive, defensive stance here, attacking the candidate for his trip. In his experiences last week and yesterday, McCain held close to the theme of experience. John McCain has it. Obama, Senator McCain insists, doesn't.
I'm not questioning his patriotism. I'm questioning his actions. I'm questioning his total lack of understanding.
I basically met with the same folks that John McCain met with after he won the nomination. He met with all these leaders. He also added a trip to Mexico, a trip to Canada, a trip to Colombia. And nobody suggested that that was audacious.
John McCain has tried to make a national debate out of Obama's Senate vote against the troop surge in Iraq. It was something he hammered on repeatedly in appearances last week and something he picked up on the Sunday shows yesterday.
He chose to take a political path that would have helped him get the nomination of his party. I took a path that I knew was unpopular because I knew we had to win in Iraq, and we are winning in Iraq.
But who's winning the hearts and minds in America this summer? Poll numbers suggest the campaign may be in a hot weather summer doldrum deep freeze. People may be aware of the campaign and understand the issues after the intense primary season, but it appears the electorate may have taken a break in the last few weeks. John McCain has not gained on Obama in the past month, nor has Obama pulled decisively ahead of McCain. The most recent Wall Street Journal NBC News poll shows McCain 6 points behind Obama. If there is some kind of bump or erosion in the polls as a result of Obama's overseas trip, we should know later in the week. For now, the campaign seems to most Americans kind of like the first day of school. It's important, sure, but nothing they absolutely have to think about right now, Adore.
Oh, important. I was actually, John, with about 7,000 journalists over the weekend, journalists of color. I had a big conference in Chicago.
And you're at Unity, right?
Unity, yeah.
And so was Barack Obama.
He was there. John McCain was not. But interestingly enough, I talked to dozens of journalists, and they all said the same thing, whether they were from Boston, Atlanta, Miami, Seattle, Portland, L.A. They've been surprised at how engaged people have been in this election cycle, not just through the primaries, which were very exciting, but even now and following the daily ups and downs of what each candidate is doing.
The polls seem to be holding steady, though. That's kind of the mystery now. The question is what happens when we get into the conventions and then beyond.
Right, and we're talking weeks at this point.
That's
right. We're moving right into those conventions. It's going to speed up. So maybe we'll see some VP announcements in the next week
or two.
Possibly
the next event.
We'll see, but we will see the beginning of the Olympics. That's for sure, right? The Beijing Olympics were just days away, essentially. And as the countdown races towards the very first event at the Beijing Olympics today, a BBC investigation has uncovered questions about how the track cycling sport of Keirin managed to make its way into the games and whether it was a few million dollars that helped pave the way. Keirin's a Japanese sport you may or may not have heard of that began in 1948. It's a short sprint race where riders can go more than 40 miles an hour, and it's a popular betting sport which landed in the Olympics in 2000. BBC correspondent Matt McGrath joins us now with his report. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, good morning to you guys.
What did you uncover in your investigation?
We've been looking into allegations that the choice of the Keirin as an Olympic event wasn't all down to its sporting merits. The race, as you say, has been hugely successful, but specifically Japanese for decades. And as you say, it's been quite rich as well. They allow a lot of betting on races and they gain a lot of revenue from that. In the 1980s, the Japanese successfully lobbied cycling's world governing body, they're called the UCI, to get them into the World Championships, which they did. And in 1996, the Japanese lobbied the UCI to get into the Olympics, which they did. But in the years that have intervened, there have been a number of allegations that have kept surfacing that the Japanese had provided large amounts of money to the UCI. Now we've been provided with documents that show that this is the case.
And what kind of documents do you have, and what exactly do you believe they show?
Okay, the documents we've got include contracts drawn up between the UCI and the Japanese that say they take into account the special relationship that the UCI has with the Olympic movement. The contract stipulates the amount of money the Japanese will then pay. We also have detail on what the actual money was spent on. These include paying for flights for UCI officials, including the president, Hein Verbruggen. In 1 6-month period, the Japanese paid for 5 flights for Mr. Verbruggen to the Netherlands for UCI business. A source who was within the UCI at the time says that these payments were for activities the UCI should have been paying for themselves, and the source says that it was purely a way of getting money into the UCI in return for promoting the Keirin into the Olympics.
Now, you mentioned former UCI president Hein Verbruggen. He's actually now the chairman of the organizing committee for the Beijing Olympics. What's his response to these allegations?
As you say, yes, he is one of the most powerful men in world sport organizing the Olympics in Beijing, and also a former head of the UCI cycling body. He strenuously denies any wrongdoing. And of course, I must add, there is no evidence that he personally profited in any way from this transaction. But he says that the money was all legitimately done, legitimately accounted for. It was a legitimate arrangement. Everything was open and transparent. And, you know, that this was a perfectly normal arrangement in these circumstances.
And what do you think the implications are for the Olympics? Does it really raise questions about access and the legitimacy and credibility of the sports that are participating?
I think it does raise some questions, particularly about access and how you get in and out of the games. The Olympics are very good, and they've learned down the years to be very good. If a new sport wants to get in, say baseball or rugby or some sport that's new, they vet the process very carefully. But if a sport is already established, like cycling or athletics, and they want to change one of the running orders in their sport and put in a new event that's slightly different from another one, they don't get the same vetting process. The Olympics just want to know, are there going to be costs for the organisers, or are there going to be more competitors? If those questions are answered okay, then they don't have a major investigative process. And this is a bit of a loophole. We've seen this particularly with the Karen. You'd have thought maybe that the IOC, having had a lot of scandals back in the 80s and 90s,
exactly,
with Salt Lake City and all that, that they might have actually learned to tighten up their procedures. But in this case, it doesn't seem to be the case. And we don't know how many other sporting events or sports could have used their financial leverage to get their way into the games.
You know, Matt, I want to ask you a question that's more about the culture of the Olympics and the culture of betting. I know it's not the focus of your investigation, but I mean, you know, it's not unknown for people to bet on sports in the Olympics. And I'm wondering if betting becomes something of an incentive to bring sports onto the Olympic stage. And that in this particular case, that might have had something to do with what went on.
It's hard to know with regards to the Karen. I think a lot of what was specifically about the Karen was about prestige. It is a hugely gambling-driven race in Japan. There's no doubt about that, and it makes a lot of money from that. In the rest of the world, track cycling doesn't have as much of a gambling culture. It isn't. People don't bet on it as much. I think the motivation for Japan wanting their race into the Olympics was purely prestige. Whether or not then it would attract more riders that would come and make their races in Japan more competitive and enhance the gambling opportunities there, I don't know. Gambling on Olympic events, at least in Europe and from a European perspective, isn't really a huge thing either. So I don't know if gambling has played a big part in it. I do know that prestige and being seen as a global sport was very much a part of this.
It's interesting to think about, that's for sure.
Matt McGrath, many thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Matt McGrath, he's a correspondent for the BBC World Service, bringing us a report about keirin, the Japanese cycling sport now in the Olympics.
Ever played jacks?
As in bounce
jacks,
the ball,
you know, bounce
pick
the ball,
up
pick
a jack?
Up jacks,
yes,
yeah.
I have.
How much do you think it would cost to pay to get jacks into the Olympics? There's a takeaway question
more than
for you.
More than you and I have, I think.
if you would like a sport in the Olympics, what would you pay to put in the Olympics? More seriously, we're actually talking about pardons. Who would you pardon? The Bush administration is actually preparing a list to look at of people to pardon in the waning days of the administration. Presidents have the power to pardon. Who do you think either should be pardoned? Or who would you pardon if you had the ultimate power?
And did you know something that's interesting? Mm-hmm. It's not only people who put in an application to get pardoned. The president can pardon anybody he wants to who's been convicted of a federal crime. So he may be considering people who are not even put themselves on that list.
I may be speaking out of turn, but I think there's even some sort of constitutional discussion over whether a president can pardon him or herself.
Oh, that's an interesting
one. The power is so unrestricted.
You're not likely to still be in office, though, if you're convicted of a felony.
Well, it's an interesting point.
It's called impeachment.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
If you're out of office, then, you know, that's what happened to Nixon. More about that later.
Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. And good morning to you, 91-year-old Marvin Miller.
Good morning.
Good morning. I guess it's the case that there are still some people in baseball who think you're the devil incarnate, correct?
could be.
Former executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, Marvin Miller, is on the line with me. And at the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies in Cooperstown, New York yesterday, Miller wasn't there, but two historic figures in the game, both non-players, the late Dodger owner Walter O'Malley and the late baseball commissioner Bowie Kuhn, joined the game's honored ranks. Here's Kuhn's stepson, Paul DeGeneres, speaking at yesterday's ceremony.
Bowie Kuhn became commissioner of baseball during a time when the professional game was possibly at its contemporary low. It had sunk almost into an oblivion that hadn't darkened the grand old game since those disastrous days of 1919. Beginning then, when the role of commissioner was created to protect the game from so many evils, the game grew and grew to become an everyday part of American life.
Well, that's one version of the story. Certainly absent from yesterday's ceremony was a man whom Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer Red Smith called the second most important man in baseball after Babe Ruth. Marvin Miller, you know, you weren't there yesterday, but what were your thoughts as Bowie Kuhn was inducted into the Hall of Fame? You used to drive him nuts.
Well, the induction is fine, you know. That's their business. The speeches, though, were something else. It was a complete rewriting of history. I don't know where his stepson, for example, got the material that he used. I can guess it came from the Hall of Fame people, from President Idelson, who was a PR person. I was there, and baseball was not in the doldrums in 1969.
Right. Well, let's step back for a second, because really what happened at the Hall of Fame yesterday sort of plays up this tension that's always existed between the players and the owners. You, as head of the Players Association, ushered in the era of players' rights, free agency, really, and free agency is half of what is talked about on sports media these days, what the contracts are, what the players are going to be getting, and when they become free agents.
That's true.
Describe the tension as you experienced it with Bowie Kuhn and Walter O'Malley in your days in baseball.
Well, I wouldn't couple them. I didn't have any tensions with Walter O'Malley. On the contrary, we got along fine. And most of the time I got along with Kuhn, too. But he was steeped in a different kind of tradition than I was. He believed all the hype about the commissioner representing everybody, that the commissioner was a czar, and that he represented the owners, the players, the umpires, the citizens at large, the fans. And it was nonsense, of course. He was simply an employee with absolutely no power except what was ceded to him by the owners. They paid him. They recruited him. They told him what his duties were. They told him what his powers were. And in the case of just about every commissioner, except those who died in office, they were all fired when they displeased enough of the owners.
Well, certainly, free agency took a lot of money out of the pocket of the owners. But what do you say to the argument that the whole free agency system has created the New York Yankees' ability to have the highest payroll in baseball? They bid up all the stars. And really, you know, the league is dominated by a couple of very, very, well-heeled teams.
Yeah. Neither league is dominated by any teams. This is one of the fallacies that people who don't read the record book, who don't read the newspapers. The Yankees haven't won for 6 or 7 years now, for example. High payroll or no high payroll. Competitive balance in the major leagues is far superior to what it was before there was free agency. Before there was free agency, then the Yankees dominated the American League, for example, and baseball altogether. Just a few teams. This is in the era now of no free agents. All players were pieces of property. Between the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Cardinals, almost nobody else ever won a pennant or a World Series.
Well, do you think you'll ever be in the Hall of Fame, Marvin, before we go?
No, I've already indicated in a public letter to the writers who do the nominating. I've asked them to please not do it again. Don't nominate me anymore. The whole thing has become a farce. to realize that what's going on is you must realize that when they have an election, as they do, each year or each 2 years or each 4 years, they simply rig the entire thing for whatever result they want.
Well, certainly the labor history story of baseball has not been told at the Hall of Fame. Perhaps someday it will be, and your name will be first on the list. Marvin Miller, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
91-year-old Marvin Miller, former executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, and now headlines from Femi Okeke.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes past the hour. There have been a string of deadly attacks in Iraq today. Suicide bombers have struck Shiite pilgrims on the way to a Baghdad shrine and Kurds rallying in the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. In all, about 40 people have been killed and about 150 injured. The last of the rain from Hurricane Dolly has dumped an extra 6 inches in Rio de Sol, New Mexico. 2 people were swept away and an estimated 60 homes have been damaged. And the Taliban's use of bases in Pakistan to launch attacks on Afghanistan will be among the topics addressed today when President Bush sits down at the White House with Pakistan's Prime Minister Yusuf Jalani. And finally, the Olympic Village opened this morning. The Chinese national anthem was played, confetti filled the air, and the Olympic Village opened up for 16,000 competitors and officials. Now, China's athletes were the very first to check in. They have luxury apartments which will partly run on solar power. You're looking impressed,
Adora. 16,000, you forget how large it is.
It's a lot of people.
Solar
a lot
power
of people there.
In Beijing. The sun can't even get through the haze.
Well, there is a downside to the Olympic story today, and that is that smog is at its very worst in Beijing than it has been for the last month. They've been measuring it every day, trying to make sure the pollution stays down. Today is a bad day, and we're 12 days away from the official start.
I thought they shut down all the factories, and they were making all kinds of efforts to
get cars off the roads.
It's not working.
It's
Thanks,
a problem. Honey. You're welcome.
Good morning on this Monday, July 28th. We're going to take a look at illegal immigration, and we're talking about Connecticut, not exactly the first state you might think of. It has 3.5 million people. It's hardly among the largest states in the U.S. or has the largest illegal immigration population. But like so many places, so many states, it's struggling with the issue. In the absence of a federal policy, local governments are coming up with programs, creating a hodgepodge of inconsistent policies, and two different cities in Connecticut have come up with two very different strategies. And joining us with a study in contrast is Ashwina Anbarajanin, a blogger for Feet in Two Worlds, a project of the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School, linking ethnic media and public radio. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us. And let's start with the city of New Haven. It's home to Yale University and essentially a pilot program that began a year ago. It's a controversial plan that gives
immigrants ID cards. What it basically does, they just celebrated their one-year anniversary of giving illegal immigrants identification cards that allow them to open bank accounts, they use it as debit cards when they go to stores. It gives them a form of ID in lieu of, let's say, a driver's license that allows them to access city services. And it's designed to bring these people out of the shadows and integrate them more into the community. And, of course, it's been very controversial because of that.
There was lawsuits. There have been lawsuits.
There have been lawsuits
the program.
About the program, because one of the things, when the program started, I mean, people were very shocked because how, you know, it's basically saying that despite whatever federal policy is, no matter if you don't have a green card or you're not a citizen, we're going to make you a part of our community. And what they did was they brought these, they created the cards, they started handing them out, they used, ironically, the same system that the U.S. Treasury Department uses to allow illegal immigrants to pay their taxes, to give them IDs. And now, and when that happened, I mean, there was a huge uproar across the country. I mean, New Haven is a tiny little city, but across the country, people's attention was focused on it, and it was very, very controversial.
Well, how does ethnic media, and that's what you're affiliated with, mm-hmm. cover both the controversy and also give people the facts and information that they need to know to act on the policy in their own interest?
Well, I think that ethnic media is media. It's journalism. It has ethics. It has follows rules. I mean, I think the point is to maybe bring some more stories out there and actually cover it. I mean, when you look at the one-year anniversary of this program that's going on, didn't get a lot of coverage. But it's been in place. It's doing well. It has national partners now across the country that are funding it even more. And they've expanded the program to actually target low-income minorities across the spectrum, legal or illegal, because the ID card actually helps people access credit services. It creates a virtual bank, and many low-income African-Americans, Hispanics, don't have access to credit
don't
or
have
to banks.
Banks in their community.
Right.
You're talking about check cashing. And the goal was to hand out about roughly 5,000 of these IDs.
Right.
But it's gone to many more than those 5,000.
It's gone to about 6,500. And one of the things I question about the program is how effective is it? Because the irony of it is that, let's say, if you want to open a bank account, the card is a secondary form of ID. You still need to do certain things. You still need a driver's license or a passport, or even if it's a foreign passport, in order to access some services. But they've expanded it. It's grown to 6,500. And one of the reasons that they told me that it didn't even get bigger is because they need to make sure that the city services that these people who have the cards are accessing can support them. And they live in the city, too. Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly one strategy. That's a very different tactic, though, than 40 miles away in Danbury,
right,
Connecticut, where you have essentially some of the police officers there being deputized as federal agents. Explain that for us.
Exactly. Danbury decided to take a very different approach. They said that there is a problem with illegal immigration. There's been some crime. There's been crowded housing. We don't know how to handle this problem well. So what we're going to do is take five officers. It's a national program known as 287G, and it trains them to be federal law enforcement. I mean, federal law enforcement, immigration.
You're basically an arm of Immigration and
Customs.
Which gives them the jurisdictional power to arrest illegal
immigrants,
which is something that local police don't have.
Right. And, you know, deport them and ask them, you know, if they're illegal immigrants. And it's a very, very different policy than a place like New Haven, because the question is, how do you approach crime with illegal immigration? How do you approach it? I mean, do you want to have immigrants cooperate with you, or is it a question of you're not getting the information that you need, so you're going to allow people to say, you know, we're going to use this as a tool of law enforcement, that if people are committing crimes and they're illegal, we can get them out of our communities and we can
deport them. How has that worked? Has there been any measurement there in Danbury?
You know, I'm from Danbury. I grew up there. You haven't really, there was a huge outcry when the program came in. There were a lot of protests. But you haven't really seen any kind of misuse yet. There have been cases in other states where there's been racial profiling, and there have been abuses in the program, but that hasn't happened as of yet in Danbury.
Is there fear and vigilance on the part of the undocumented immigrants in that community about the enforcement policy?
I think so. I mean, I think that there have been advocates speaking for them who are very, very opposed to it. But at the same time, and I said this in something that I wrote about it, you can still find people, you know, it's a common occurrence from the people in the suburbs around Danbury that you can hire day laborers, you mm-hmm. can go in. There's a thriving community. There are more businesses. There's construction. And these people are being supported by, and these businesses are being supported by illegal immigration and illegal workers who have come in and are part, you know, are part of the economy.
So even though the policies are radically different in these two communities, in fact, the way the communities are responding is maybe closer than you might think.
Oh, I don't know if I would call it closer, because, I mean, one is really trying to bring them in. It's
right.
about giving them an ID card. The other is saying that we have the option to use your immigration mm-hmm. status against you if you commit a crime, and at times we can look the other way also, you know.
We're going to ask you to stick around with us, and I want you to help me with the last name here. It's Ashwini is your first name.
Ashwini Unbarajan.
Unbarajan. Thank you very much, and you're going to hang with us for a second, because right now we're going to get the headlines from Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. 20 minutes to the hour. 17 people have been killed and more than 150 wounded by two explosions in Istanbul, Turkey. The lawyer for ex-Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic says that supporters of his client are planning a huge rally tomorrow in Belgrade. Karadzic is expected to be extradited to The Hague tomorrow to stand trial for war crimes. Police and the FBI are searching for clues as to why a man opened fire yesterday at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church. Two people were killed and seven others were injured.
and an out-of-control telegraph fire is still burning near an entrance to
Yosemite.
Thank you very much. National Park in California. It's destroyed 12 homes and residents from 200 homes have been ordered to evacuate. I knew it would be helpful sitting next to you this morning. It's a quick look at your headlines.
It's your lucky day, Femi.
I know. I'm blessed.
You mispronounce Yosemite again, we're going to ask for your, you know, ID card. Come on. Let's bring that up in public on radio.
Yeah. I do have it, though, with me, just in case.
Just in case. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
17 people killed and more than 150 injured in two bomb explosions in the Turkish city of Istanbul in the midst of a passionate debate over ethnic tensions and the role of religion in politics. Muammar Guler, who's the governor of Istanbul, condemned the attack this morning.
Unfortunately, the fact that the explosion took place in a crowded place increased the number of casualties. At present, the wounded are being treated in various hospitals. An extensive investigation is being conducted at present at the scene of the incident. There is no doubt that this is a terrorist attack.
Joining us now from Istanbul is Sarah Rainsford, BBC correspondent. Sarah, thanks for joining us. What can you say about the attack right now, and is there a claim of responsibility yet?
Well, things are developing quite fast now. This attack, I can tell you, happened at 10 o'clock last night. It happened in a busy residential area of Istanbul. There were people out, adults and children, out on the street. It was a hot summer's day yesterday. They'd come out in the evening to enjoy some cool air to visit the cafes and the shops when these two devices were detonated. The first, a percussion bomb, which was specifically designed to draw people, curious people, to find out what all the noise was about. That happened when hundreds of people had gathered. Then a second device went off, and that's when many people were killed, fatally wounded or injured more lightly. So we're talking now about 17 people who've died, including five children, according to the Istanbul governor, and six women. There are at least 50 people still in hospital, and I understand that six of them are in a critical condition.
Turkish authorities suggest this is a PKK attack, or it looks like it. That would mean that it's a part of the debate over Kurdish independence and Kurdish status within Turkey. But there's also a passionate debate about the role of religion in politics that's right in the middle of this election. Where do you think this attack here might affect the debate and affect the election?
There are several theories at the moment about who might have been behind this attack. As you say, the authorities are beginning to make their most open statements yet, that they believe that there's a link to the PKK, the separatist Kurdish group that's been fighting the Turkish military for more than two decades here in Turkey. The governor of Istanbul said he said exactly that there appears to be a link with the group. He says that the authorities are working on that and hope to get a result at the first opportunity. That follows reports from the police here, who told journalists off the record that the explosives used in these explosions were the same as those used in attacks that have previously been blamed on the PKK, both in Ankara and in the southeast of the country. So they saw very clearly a PKK link. But there are other theories. As you say, other groups have operated here in Turkey in the past, exploding devices and carrying out attacks of a similar nature. That includes, of course, Islamist groups, a group linked to Al-Qaeda, for example, 5 years ago. Staged a devastating attack here in Istanbul in which more than 60 people were killed when they targeted, amongst other things, the British consulate here. So there are a huge number of theories still doing the rounds here. And as you mentioned, it comes at an extremely tense time in Turkey, a time not of elections, but when the governing party, which won 47% of the vote at the last election, is now on trial and facing closure. The party accused of being pro-Islamic, of trying to change secular Turkey, and facing being closed down. The judges are actually meeting in Ankara as we meet to discuss
certainly
that.
Certainly a time of passion and much instability there in Istanbul as people clean up from this explosion. Sarah Rainsford, BBC correspondent, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's Monday, July 28th. I almost want to say Thursday there, John, but I guess that would be wrong. Today would be Monday, July 28th.
Get the medication, please.
Sitting right next to me is Femi Okay, because she has the latest headlines that we're dying to hear. Femi?
That would be lying, and lying twice as well. Your nose just grew. 12 minutes to the hour. Just hours after two deadly bomb attacks in Istanbul, a Turkish court has begun deliberations on whether the ruling AK party should be closed down for becoming the focus of pro-Islamist activity. Three suicide attacks targeting Shia Muslims on a pilgrimage in Baghdad killed 28 and wounded more than 90. Human Rights Watch is calling for foreign military aid to Kenya to be stopped until an independent inquiry is held into allegations of widespread human rights abuses during a military operation in the west of the country earlier this year. And researchers in London say that children carrying the first gene clearly linked to obesity find it harder than others to tell when they're four. That's an interesting piece of science.
Absolutely. Femi, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
It's about that time of year, John. They're talking presidential pardons. Applications are running at all-time highs, which means President Bush will be busy considering the files through his final days of office. And on the docket, some famous federal convicts, like former Olympic runner Marion Jones, former California Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham, and John Walker Lind. Remember him?
Sure.
The so-called American Taliban. But they may not want to get their hopes up too high. President Bush has handed out very few pardons in his nearly 8 years in office, and that's compared to his father, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Joining us now is Margaret Love, a former pardon attorney of the United States under President George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I'm very happy to be here.
Why is there such a rush now with just months left in this Bush administration?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Apparently, people seem to think that that the president, or most presidents, give out a lot of pardons at the end of their term. And actually, historically, that really has not been the case.
It's not true.
Well, not historically, no. For the most part, presidents have given pardons pretty regularly throughout their term. And it was really only with President Clinton that pardoning at the very end of the term in the federal system happened. And so I guess people remember the Clinton pardons and they think, well, maybe something like that's going to happen this time.
Margaret, let me ask you a more basic question. Why in the world should anyone get a pardon if you're convicted in a court of law and you've gone through your appeals process and it's upheld that it was correctly handled? Why should anyone get a pardon?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and it does kind of go to the whole issue of what a pardon means. If you think about, well, let me say that there are two different kinds of things that the president can do with his pardon power these days, two main things. Number one, he can commute a sentence, and we saw that with the Scooter Libby grant last summer. He can actually reduce or cut entirely a prison sentence.
Mm-hmm.
If someone, for example, is serving a 20-year sentence for a crack cocaine violation, and the president decides that 20 years is really too much and 10 or 12 is enough, he can commute the sentence. The other kind of thing that the president does is to pardon, and that usually these days takes place long after an entire sentence is served, and it's not supposed to reflect on the sentence itself. It's not supposed to signify that the sentence was wrong or something like that.
But I mean, isn't that a question of semantics? Because that's essentially what it does. If the president is deciding that somehow someone is unfairly convicted,
well,
then it's essentially jury nullification on the one hand.
Well,
and then
if they've already served the sentence. If they've already served the sentence. Then.
No, but subverting what the judge has ruled was a legitimate conviction. Essentially, it is jury nullification.
Well, it's not really. And this is the interesting thing. If you think about a pardon as somehow reflecting on what happened with the conviction, then, of course, you do have this problem. But that's not what a pardon has meant in these past 100 years, for example. There are a lot of things that happen to you as a result of a conviction. You have many legal disabilities. You have the stigma of conviction. And people come to the president for a pardon long after their sentence is entirely served, and they're really not looking for any sort of vindication their pardon is really a forgiveness.
So Margaret, if someone is a felon and they're pardoned by the president, they can vote again?
Oh, well, you know, voting is another thing. Voting in most states, it's controlled by state law. Voting in most states is restored either when you get out of prison immediately and automatically or when you finish your sentence. So there are only probably three or four states in the entire country where voting is not restored. But yes, that is actually the kind of thing that is restored by a pardon. Many jobs, for example, are entirely closed to people with a conviction.
So tell us about your time and what the standard was while you were serving as a pardon attorney.
Well, that's a very good question. The standard, which is, it's kind of vague, and there are certain places in the federal regulations where standards are laid out. But we always looked when we were considering pardons, and I'm distinguishing that from the sentence commutation, we always looked to how a person had lived their life, what effect the conviction had had on them, and whether they had managed to take a lesson away from having been convicted. Had they gone back to their community after perhaps serving a sentence in prison and really kind of made an effort to make up for what they had done? And if we all also, this was in the Justice Department that we were looking at these convictions, we also kind of looked to see what a pardon, what signal a pardon would send to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Was this something that would tell them that the criminal justice system had functioned successfully?
Speaking of the public, is there any relationship, you think, between the amount of press a person gets as they're asking for a pardon and the likelihood that they'll actually receive that pardon or commutation?
Yeah, it's been my experience that it isn't really very helpful to get a lot of press before the president acts. It tends to be very discouraging. And so I would not ever recommend to a client of mine that he get a lot of coverage. But that said, it is not at a bit unhelpful.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes can be very useful to have people advocating on your behalf in a quiet way.
A quiet way. Behind closed doors? But Margaret, my final question to you is, there's a real backlog right now that you talk about, and you also at the same time are seeing record applications this year, like of Marion Jones and Randy Duke Cunningham and John Walker Lynn. What's the likelihood that President Bush is actually going to get through these 2,000 new requests?
Well,
not to mention the 2,300 already backlogged.
Sure. With all these famous names, people kind of forget that there are many, many ordinary people who apply for pardon and who really need it. There are hundreds of applications coming in. I have not had any particular expectation that this president would do a lot of pardons at the end, which really means that there will be a lot of pardons left over and carried over to the next president's term. So I expect that whoever the next president is, whether it's Senator Obama uh-huh. or Senator McCain, he's going to start off his
with a lot of names on that list.
A lot of names.
Margaret Love, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Margaret Love is a former pardon attorney in the Clinton administration, and we have a friend of ours here, Ashwina. And give me your last name.
Anbarajan.
Anbarajan. Who would you like to? Who would you like to pardon?
Oh, I don't know.
Like any teachers who you think were a little harsh and they need to be.
Well, they were never put away in the first place.
They were never put right, exactly. She wants them convicted. She wants them taken out.
I'm saying in a theoretical world. We don't have to be absolutely literal here.
I can think of some high school guidance counselors I might call
them. Well, you did well. You did well despite them. Indeed. Thanks for being with us, Ashwini.
Oh, thank you.
Today on The Takeaway, the presidential campaign continues, and so does the fight for the hearts and minds of American voters. The Olympic sport, Karen, it was a new sport in 2000, but were kickbacks involved? Which sports do you want to see in the Olympics?
And communities try to manage undocumented immigrants. A bomb rips apart a residential neighborhood in Turkey. And it's that time again, presidential pardons. These are all stories we've been covering. Who's asking for them? Who may get them? Who do you want to pardon? Weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at www.thetakeaway.org.
It's Monday. Have a great week. I'm John Hockenberry. From fugitive war criminal to the kindly Dr. Dabik, Radovan Karadzic managed to disappear in his own country with the help of the latest identity-changing technology. A look at the state of the art when you really need to drop out of sight. Thinking about Plan C on a Monday morning. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, July 28th. Today, a look at just how hard it is to disappear in the world, even for an internationally wanted man. Credit, it's getting harder for businesses to get their hands on money. How much of a problem is it? Afghanistan and the poppy fields. Well, the poppy fields are at record levels this year. And politics, a wrap on the race for president. Those stories and the rest of the day's news. In Istanbul, at least 16 people have been killed and more than 150 injured in two explosions in a busy Turkish residential district. So far, no group has claimed responsibility, but Turkish security services say the bombings look like the work of the Kurdish separatist group, the PKK. In Iraq, bomb attacks today in Baghdad and Kirkuk. In Baghdad, three female suicide bombers and a roadside attack took place in quick succession. At least 28 people were killed and more than 70 wounded. The bombings took place as tens of thousands of Shiite pilgrims flooded into the capital for an annual religious pilgrimage. In Kirkuk, Iraqi officials say a suicide bomber struck a Kurdish rally, killing 11 people, wounding 54.
Police in Knoxville, Tennessee, along with the FBI, are searching for clues as to why a man opened fire at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church yesterday morning. Two adults died and seven others were wounded. An out-of-control wildfire is still burning near an entrance to Yosemite National Park in California. The Telegraph Fire has already consumed a dozen homes, and officials have ordered the evacuation of 200 more.
A congressionally mandated audit of reconstruction efforts in Iraq has found that contractors in Iraq botched a prison contract so badly that only two buildings in the compound are usable, though not for housing prisoners. Stuart Bowen is the chief inspector.
This is $40 million invested in a project with very little return.
The contractor, Parsons Corporation, says it was doing the best it could under difficult circumstances. In politics, John McCain is holding a $1,000 a plate luncheon in Seven Oaks, California. This afternoon, Barack Obama is meeting today with his top economic advisors.
Oil is trading at $123 a barrel and change in Asian trading, but it may be facing more instability. Nigeria's main militant group says it attacked two major oil pipelines in the Delta region. The markets are poised to open flat this morning. The Dow begins at 11,370. The S&P opens at 1257. Who would you pardon? Here's an answer.
My suggestions, Abu Mumia Jamal, the black journalist who's got a weak case against him for allegedly shooting a Philadelphia police officer, and all the American GIs who refused to fight Bush's immoral and illegal invasion of Iraq.
It's pardon season as the Bush administration comes to a close, and we've been talking about who the Bush administration might pardon, who's on the list, and who would you pardon? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Who would you pardon, John?
You know, I'd pardon, like, Mark David Chapman so they could come in here and be interviewed on this show. That's what I'd do.
Oof,
John Walker Lynn.
That would be controversial.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. I've got two words for you, and you know them if you pay attention to the news. Credit crunch. What does it mean? Well, if you're a consumer, it may mean that you can't get a car loan. It may mean it's more difficult to get a mortgage. It may mean that your credit line on your credit card has been shrinking. But when we talk about businesses, we're really talking about the lifeblood of the U.S. economy. Two vital forms of credit used by companies, commercial and industrial paper, from not backed by collateral, collectively dropped almost 3% over the last year. That's the largest annual decline since credit tightening began in the last recession. Joining us to talk about the effect of the credit crunch on business loans and therefore economic growth in the United States is Peter Goodman of the New York Times. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
When a business experiences credit crunch, what are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about an inability to get hands on money. If you can't secure finance and you're running a business, that means you can't expand the way you hoped, means you can't hire new people. So it means exacerbating our unemployment situation and our general lack of spending in the economy.
From the perspective of a business who has a relationship, presumably with a bank that has lent to that business before, why should a global credit crunch change a fundamentally one-on-one relationship between a business and a bank?
Well, the banks are in a situation where they've borrowed a lot of money to lend a lot of money on mortgages, and they've lost a lot of that money. A lot of these banks are leveraged at 10, 11, 12 to 1, meaning that they lose a dollar in a bad loan, and they now have to kick out $10 in loans just to get that dollar back in terms of what they have to hang on to reserve against other bad loans. So a lot of banks are in a position where they're giving up perfectly good loans just as a way to shrink their overall exposure to the market. And we're also in a situation where, overall, the financial system has lost, some people think, $1 trillion on this mortgage crisis, and they've recognized about $300 billion in the losses, which means, there's like $700 billion left out there waiting to be discovered in bad loans.
Some of this also relates to a kind of macro global repricing of debt of all kinds. How much of this is driven by the debt holders, people, investors in Japan and in the Gulf and in China, looking at the portfolios of these banks and saying, I'm not going to pay that for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a factor. Overall, there's this uncertainty. I mean, we went through a period where credit was so cheap and so loose around the world. Things that were actually quite risky seemed not so risky, and banks were investing in things that were a little more risky to get a little extra return because there was just so much capital surging through the global economy. So now we're in a position where banks are short of capital, and they're scared to invest in this climate, and nobody really knows, what's a good investment, what's a risky investment, what's not so risky, because our fundamental belief system has broken down in how we assess risk.
But Peter, is it a swing perhaps too far to the other extreme, which is when you're talking about some of the businesses like you profiled in your piece, these are people who have long-standing relationships with banks. They are businesses that are expanded, and they want to expand further. So the mechanism by which the banks are now taking a look at whether or not to loan money, have they gone too far to the other continuum and holding on to their purse strings?
Well, there are certainly some people who think that. There's no question that we've gone from sort of an indiscriminate lending. You walk in the door, you can sign your name, you got a pulse, you got a loan, we're not loaning to anybody. And, there's no question that there are parts of this economy that are still very strong. I mean, anybody who's exporting today is doing quite well because the dollar is really weak and there's still, for the time being at least, pretty strong global demand, at least in many parts of the world.
Peter, that's a catchy slogan for a bank. You got a pulse, you got a loan. I think that's pretty good. There's some future there, but not likely in this environment, right?
Well, if journalism doesn't work out, maybe, yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's too many financial jobs for me or anybody else today.
Peter Goodman, thanks for joining us. New York Times correspondent Peter Goodman focusing on the credit crunch and its effect on businesses in the New York Times.
I'd be so curious to see how that evolves because it all seems so day to day. We're going to take a look now at Guantanamo Bay. Nearly everything surrounding the detention of Guantanamo Bay prisoners, John, as we've been talking about on many shows, has been shrouded in secrecy controlled by the military. And that, along with the geography of the place itself, has made it tough for reporters to cover just about in every sense of the word. Currently, the trial of Osama bin Laden's former driver is going into its second week. Journalists covering it have had to abide by very strict Pentagon rules. One such journalist is USA Today's Alan Gomez. He has just returned, and he joins us now. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
Now, give us a sense of what those rules were set by the Pentagon.
Wow. Okay. Not quite sure where to begin there, but it's.
Let's start at the beginning. For you to get to Guantanamo Bay, what do you have to do? You don't just call American Airlines and make a reservation, do you?
Well, exactly. You have to. What they're doing right now for the media is we have to fly down on pre-selected media flights that we have to be approved on very early in advance. And for example, for this Hamdan trial, their original intention was to have us go down there on July 12th, even though the trial didn't start until the 21st. So as you can imagine, for people, it's kind of hard to be down there for about a month and a half to cover a trial. So that that was the beginning of many complications.
So they were requiring you to be there on the 12th?
Exactly. As they explained it to us, that as a matter of transparency, they wanted to make sure that we could be there for all the pretrial motions and things like that, and pretty much every media organization had to get together to lobby the Pentagon to allow us to go down on a flight closer to the beginning of the trial, which they ended up doing. We got down there the day after the trial started on a military flight, but that took quite a bit of emails, phone calls, and harassment before that came through.
And even when you got there, now having missed the opening statements of the trial, were you had an escort, right? And what did that person do? I mean, did they sleep next to you in the bunk or what?
Not quite that close, but no doubt that you could not go anywhere on base. You could not go anywhere without having some sort of escort with you. Understanding it's a Navy base, so we kind of understand it at some point. But, Guantanamo generally is a very laid-back base, lovely beaches, all that sort of thing down there. So to be down there and then be secluded in one area where you can't walk anywhere, aside from going from your tent, media center, to the courthouse, was obviously a little odd.
And you don't have to wear an orange suit when you're down there like the prisoners at Camp X-Ray. But what impact does it have on your reporting, this kind of scrutiny?
And actually, to correct one thing, if you do want to go jogging, you do have to wear an orange suit.
No kidding. Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, just a vest or something, just so the guards don't mistake you as you're going from place to place. But in actually covering the trial, the restrictions are rather... strange and something obviously we're not used to here in the United States. The video folks, anytime they shoot any kind of video, which isn't allowed inside the courtroom, but their video has to be screened by military folks before they can send it back. Same thing for still photographers. For the reporters, they don't actually screen our writing or anything like that. But, what you're allowed to see is obviously a little more limited than what it is in American courts.
But they're not essentially reading over what you're writing or looking through the dispatches that you're sending back to USA Today. Are they fundamentally, the hardships of dealing with this kind of monitoring, is it fundamentally changing what you're reporting?
To a small degree, I would say yes. There's some of the biggest complications arise with, not with them reading, because they absolutely do not read anything that we send down. But for example, when you're covering the trial, as in most courts, when they introduce any kind of evidence, everyone's entitled to get that evidence. If they show a video, you can get a copy. If they show a PowerPoint presentation, both of which they've done during the course of this trial, you're allowed to see it afterwards and review it and things like that. Not the case in this one. We're not quite sure if it's security or what kind of reasons, but we haven't been given any of that.
So you get a quick look at it just as the jury does. But it's also a different kind of trial, right? Because you're talking about military members on this jury, and they get to ask questions just like the judge. Did you see any of that?
Not as of yet. I know during jury selection, they were talking a little bit more back and forth. The judge himself has asked questions of a couple of the witnesses, very brief questions. But, that's something that's more common for military commissions of any sort, but obviously unique to this one as well.
Alan Gomez, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Alan Gomez reports for USA Today, and he just returned from Guantanamo Bay.
Where it's unlikely that anyone at Camp X-Ray will be pardoned by the Bush administration, but we're asking about the list of people that every administration gets, periodically throughout its entire time in office, who to pardon. The Constitution allows the president to pardon in an unrestricted way virtually anyone. Who would you pardon if you were the president? Who do you think should be pardoned?
Marion Jones has asked for a pardon. John Walker Lynn has asked for a pardon, and Randall Duke Cunningham, the former congressman from California. Do you think any of them deserve a pardon? 8778 My Take. Good morning. It's Monday, July 28th. And in the aftermath of the U.S. war against the Taliban in Afghanistan, there were great hopes that a byproduct of that would be cracking down on the poppy trade, potentially stifling the heroin that floods American cities. Today, though, poppies are reaching new highs. One former State Department official says not only was drug trafficking not a priority of the U.S., but that in many ways the trade has been protected for both Afghan President Hamid Karzai's foes, but friends as well. Joining us now is Thomas Schweik, the former State Department official. His story ran in the New York Times Magazine. Good morning, Mr. Ambassador.
Good morning.
Could you break down this problem for us? Whose responsibility is it really to attack the poppy problem?
Well, first and foremost, it's the sovereign government of Afghanistan. I mean, it's the poppy's grown in their country, and it's grown. There's much more poppy growing now than there was even 2 or 3 years ago. So you've first got to look to the government of Afghanistan to take a leadership role. Now, of course, the international community can help. I mean, we've got a lot of people, a lot of expertise, and a lot of programs and funding we've been able to provide there, but it requires Afghan leadership.
And essentially, the U.S. went into Afghanistan to dismantle the Taliban. The Taliban now, as many have noted, is really enjoying a bit of a resurgence, in some part fueled by the drug trade and their ability to raise money through the heroin trade.
That's right. That's right. The Taliban, in Taliban-controlled areas, they basically control the trade. They tax the farmers. They tax the labs. They charge fees for transporting the drug to different places, and they make a lot of money. Now, the United Nations estimates it's $100 million a year.
So let's go back to the time when you were part of the administration and tell us about some of the disagreements among the various U.S. government agencies and the relationship to Hamid Karzai in trying to address this problem, which you say the U.S. decided really wasn't a priority.
Well, no one thought the drug trade was good in Afghanistan. The question was, should you defeat the Taliban first and then attack the drugs, or do you have to attack the drugs while you're attacking the Taliban? And the original policy that won out was to go after, well, sequencing is what they called it, go after the Taliban first and then the drugs. The problem with that approach was that the drugs were actually fueling the Taliban, and there was no way to defeat the Taliban without actually also going after the drugs. And there were some battles within the U.S. government that I document in the article about whether to sequence it or whether to go after them simultaneously.
I mean, part of the difficulty is that the heroin trade is such an enormous economic component of everything that goes on in Afghanistan. It's almost inseparable from any sort of notion of power in Afghanistan. How could the U.S. government attack it in a way that isn't sequencing and be comprehensive in any way?
Well, and first of all, we waited too long. The trade was not that big 2 or 3 years ago. It's exploded over the past 2 or 3 years, and had it been attacked early on, it would have been much more manageable. But even now, at the end of the article, I talk about 5 things we need to do. And basically, what we need to do to get rid of the heroin trade there now is, first of all, tell Karzai he'll lose our support unless he cracks down on the people in his government who are involved in the trade. That's the first thing, because you have to start at the top. But you have to hit it at every level also. Most of the opium farmers in Afghanistan are not poor. That's another myth that's dispelled in the article. In fact, poppy's grown in the wealthier parts of Afghanistan, not in the poorer parts of Afghanistan. So you start with an eradication program where you tell the farmers, switch back to wheat, which is in short supply, and that's what most of them used to be growing. Grow wheat, which we need in this country. Give them seed, give them fertilizer, even guarantee the price, which is very high right now. But then let them know if you don't do that, there will be an eradication program that goes in and knocks out the fields. That will deter the farmers from planting poppy. We've seen that in other parts of the world, and even in parts of northern Afghanistan where there is no poppy anymore, there were eradication programs that were quite successful. But then there also has to be development assistance that follows behind that. For those people that don't grow poppy, there need to be rewards. They need to see bridges and schools and roads going in. So it's a combination of incentives and disincentives that I outlined in the article that I think would work very well.
I mean, what you talk about in the article is not just simply resistance, but actually actively the Pentagon, in the example where you give the attempts by the DEA to really go in and crack down on the poppy fields, were thwarted. I mean, not only were they not helped, but they weren't allowed to use various equipment. Or you have a U.S. general in there saying that he essentially shut down anti-drug efforts. So, I mean, it was a purposeful, intentional act not to help in this effort to crack down on drugs in Afghanistan.
Yeah, there were a few examples of that I outlined in the article, and these were people. They weren't people who were in favor of drugs. They were military people who thought the drug mission was sort of a nuisance and an unnecessary activity that interfered with their military operations. And in the article, I point out that turned out to be quite short-sighted, because now, of course, the Taliban's getting a lot of its money from the drugs trade.
And I guess that's what's so confusing, Mr. Ambassador. On the one hand, if you don't have any money to fuel Taliban efforts, how do they continue to grow? And if they're getting that money from this drug trade, that it would seem like an in-tandem approach may be more effective, but perhaps that's just naive.
Well, no, I don't think you're naive at all, Adora. I think that's exactly what should be happening, and that's what the article says. But unfortunately, it took a long time for people to come to that realization. Now we've got a much, much bigger problem than we used to have.
Okay, Thomas Schweik, very, very nice to have you this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thomas Schweik is a Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. And boy, he has interesting insight there.
Yeah, it's interesting to know if Hamid Karzai would actually support the steps that he outlined there so clearly.
And now we're going to get headlines from Femi Oke. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning. 28 minutes past the hour. The death toll in two bomb blasts in Istanbul has risen to 17. The attacks have sharply increased tension as a top court is deliberating on whether to ban Turkey's governing party. President Bush will meet with Pakistan's Prime Minister Yusuf Jalani at the White House today. The chief topic will be increasing violence along the border with Afghanistan. The last of the rain from Hurricane Dolly has dumped an extra 6 inches in Rio de Sol, New Mexico. 2 people were swept away and an estimated 60 homes have been damaged. Investigators believe it was an oxygen tank explosion that exploded, caused a 9-foot hole in the side of a Qantas jet on Friday and forced it to make an emergency landing in the Philippines. The hole was actually big enough to drive a car through.
Every time you say that, it reminds me of ValuJet. Remember that plane that crashed in Florida many, many years ago?
And how big was the hole?
Oxygen tanks.
Really?
You know, everyone died in that plane crash.
They haven't actually determined whether it is the oxygen tank, but one is actually missing, and they're finding a valve and some fragments, so they're sort of heading towards that general direction.
The difference there, though, is these are oxygen tanks that the 747 carries as part of its air supply for the cabin. The ValuJet was part of the freight. It was people who were shipping these high-pressure containers.
And there are some reports from passengers on the plane. All of the passengers got down very safely on this Qantas jet, which came down on Friday. But some reports saying that when they were trying to use their oxygen mask, the oxygen actually wasn't working. So that might all just lead the clues into that same direction.
Indeed.
Okay, Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning, everybody. We are following terrorist bombings in Turkey and in Iraq this morning. Also, the markets, after appearing to open flat, are looking to be opening lower this morning based on trading that's going on in the oil markets. Also, we're asking, who would you like to pardon? Here's a question.
A pardon has gone the way of Supreme Court appointments, which used to be very balanced. A pardon now is a way of paying back. It is a favor. It is putting somebody and getting them in your debt. Some of them are noteworthy, but many of them are pardons to people that are allies.
Your response to 877-8-MY-TAKE to the question, who would you pardon? The presidential pardon season seems to be moving into full gear. The list of people to be pardoned are being considered by the administration, and we want your reaction to that. You can also reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Boy, you got to figure that it's something of an anticlimax to be back in the United States for Barack Obama. He's now back in the U.S. campaigning in places like Virginia, where he's probably not going to get 200,000 people at one of his events, or in Iowa. John McCain heads for Nevada this week, hoping to make news that will move the attention of the media and the voters his way. But it's a challenge for McCain. It's also a challenge for Barack Obama. Joining us now to talk about the challenges for both of these candidates is Adam Nagorny, watching all this for the New York Times, and our Takeaway political director, Andrea Bernstein. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you doing?
First of all, where do the candidates go from here? And, you know, if the Sunday chat shows were any indication, the battle for profile seems to be what is the most hard-fought issue at this point.
Well, I think you're going to see Obama now return to domestic issues. I think he feels he did what he needed to do in terms of his trip to the Middle East and Europe over the past week. He's in Washington over the next 2 days talking about economic issues, and then he's heading out to, I believe, Iowa and some other battleground states. John McCain's out west today doing similar campaigning.
What do you think, Andrea, Barack Obama accomplished with this trip, and how do you rate John McCain's attempt to sort of snipe at him on every issue of experience and policy on Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I think that Obama sort of was able to cross the imagination gap, which is people that were trying to imagine him as commander-in-chief, I think, probably have an easier time after last week and all of those images that were saturation media coverage everywhere. But whether it actually sort of, you know, helps him on domestic issues, which are so on people's minds, I mean, I think the importance of the economy is clear by the summit today that he's having with Bob Rubin and the other economic leaders.
John McCain in Nevada, of course, that's one of the places where the housing crisis is the worst. Adam Nagorny, do you think John McCain will be able to, you know, get himself back into the headlines? And will a serious debate on the economy develop in this campaign?
You know, I think he's been struggling, obviously, last week to get some attention. And I think it was probably all but impossible to really do it, considering how much attention was being paid to Obama. There's a natural cyclical nature to the media, and I think that you'll see, you know, just out of a sense of fairness or balance, more media coverage of Senator McCain this week. As to the issues that you're talking about, I mean, there's some very, very clear differences between Senator McCain and Senator Obama on the issues of the economy and housing. And I think one thing you have to say about this campaign is why there's been some kind of diversions at times. They've been very clear in laying out their differences on issues like tax cuts and what to do about the housing emergency.
Adam, that's what I was really surprised about. Just to go back to your first point, that there was so much whining, essentially, coming from the McCain campaign last week about all of the media attention that they were not getting. They know how this goes. John McCain has enjoyed, at times, tremendous media coverage. And last week, Obama was getting a lot of attention. And, you know, who knows what this week or next week, but as you say, essentially, there usually is this cyclical nature of coverage.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point you're making. And also, I don't really think voters care that much about candidates complaining about how much coverage they get. And I think that, you know, a lot of Democrats will say that John McCain has certainly done well with the press over the years. Part of what's going on is, I think it's called gaming the ref. In other words, by doing that, the audience is really not voters, but it's trying to make reporters feel guilty for not paying enough attention. So I think that's part of what's going on. I think some Republicans I spoke to were surprised that McCain was using last week to try to make or at least some of his people were trying to make such a big issue over press coverage. Historically, that's never been a way to do much beyond bounce up the Republican base a little bit, and I don't think that's what's going to win him the election this time.
Well, it got you some attention in the New Republic, Adam. Describe your confrontation with the Obama campaign regarding press access and their style of staying on message.
Yeah, it wasn't really complicated. I actually probably was not the best example for the point that reporter was trying to make. I had a situation where I wrote a story about a poll that we did last week, and they didn't like the way we wrote up the poll, which isn't the first time that happened, and put out a memo critical of it to some journalists that they wanted to sort of get it out there with without running it past us. It was more, they were treating us more like if we were a political opponent, but I think the story was more about the reporters, other reporters complaining that the Obama campaign is, like I must say, other front-running campaigns, think George Bush 2004, very controlling in the way it tries to deal with media, which I think is a fair point.
Going to the poll issue, Andrea, why do you think the polls seem to be pretty locked? For the last month, 6 points in the Wall Street Journal NBC poll.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. First of all, it's July, and people really do have things on their minds other than the presidential election. You know, if we looked at the polls 4 months before the Iowa caucuses, they painted a very different picture. So what happens is as an election approaches and people actually have to pull a lever or push a button, opinions crystallize, and I'm not sure that we're there yet with this campaign.
Does that make the Veep decision more important now, or make it something we'd want to do early or late, depending on the campaign?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that need to happen for both campaigns. I mean, I think the vice presidential decision will be a big one. It'll be a first, you know, big decision as a general election candidate for both of them. The conventions obviously have to go well for the candidates. There can't be anything like a swift boat for either one of them. And then I think the debate performance is in the fall, so there's a lot of things to happen to really
crystallize
opinion.
But do you think that the VP, either one of the candidates, and I'll throw this to both you, Andrea, and to you, Adam, do you think that they're likely, just given the very unique nature of this campaign this year, to announce prior to the conventions?
I think that they could. I mean, I think that Obama has signaled pretty strongly that his decision is coming right before the Democratic convention. McCain is still a bit of a wild card. It would be a way for him to sort of seize media attention and to start getting some more help out on the campaign trail from a vice presidential candidate, to get some help on fundraising. But the campaign needs to be ready.
Adam, last word.
I think there's only been one time in the past 40 years or so when a candidate's been announced during the convention. I think there could have been an argument for Senator McCain to have announced his running mate a little bit earlier, because what Andrea was saying, fundraising. You need someone to be the attack dog, if you will. But, you know, the Olympics starts in 2 weeks, so he's kind of running out of time. I don't think he wants to announce his running mate during the Olympics. My best guess is he would announce it between the Democratic convention and the Republican convention. There's about 4 days in there. But, you know, with those guys, you just never really know.
Well, you could announce it during, like, the equestrian events. So you just don't want to do it during swimming
or men's
gymnastics.
Nothing against horses or anything, but yeah, no, I agree. I think, though, that Obama's more likely to do that than
all right.
he is.
Thanks, Adam. We've got to go. Adam Nagorny, national political correspondent for The New York Times, and our takeaway political director, Andrea Bernstein. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
So presidents face piles of applications for pardons. As we all know, the Constitution says the president has an unrestricted right and authority to pardon whoever he or she wants in the course of their time in the
Anyone.
White House. Anyone. And down through history, the presidential pardon has been used in a variety of ways and has actually resulted in the expunging of convictions for very, very, very famous people. I mean, back down through history, the Whiskey Rebellion, which was a controversial tax rebellion that took place right after the Revolutionary War, motivated George Washington, in the interest of domestic tranquility, to pardon the members who fought in the Whiskey Rebellion. Also, Andrew Johnson pardoned Southerners, Confederate citizens, after the Civil War. President Jimmy Carter pardoned Vietnam draft dodgers, all pardons that were perceived to be very, very important politically. But pardons have also occurred to very, very famous people. This one probably the most famous.
Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
One of the rare pardons actually, you know, spoken about in public, on television, in a nationally broadcast speech.
5 years worth of wrongdoing just wiped off the slate in that 30-second statement.
And it began Richard Nixon's long road back. He wrote many, many books and had a measure of political credibility by the time of his death. Of course, it was probably the reason that Gerald R. Ford lost the 1976 election. Here's another famous pardon recipient.
Anybody who tells you that it is not tough, as you call it, to serve time in the federal penitentiary or state penitentiary should serve just 30 days a year, and you will find that the loneliness, solitude, uncertainties that go about being away from the outside and your family is unbelievable.
Jimmy Hoffa, pardoned by President Richard Nixon on December 23, 1971. Yes. Well, Jimmy Hoffa was involved in all kinds of things, and of course, the legend of Jimmy Hoffa, is infinite because he died under circumstances. That's right.
Well, maybe he's not dead.
Maybe he's not.
I mean,
dead.
That's the question. He just vanished in 1975.
Here's another very famous pardon recipient.
And I'm really happy to be going home, and I want to thank my parents and my sisters and Bernie and George too and all of the people on the committee to release me.
Some know her as Tanya, but that is Patty Hearst, who was in prison for almost 2 years before Jimmy Carter commuted her 7-year sentence. But it was Bill Clinton who granted her a full pardon on the last day of his presidency in 2001.
I don't really get pardons.
You don't
get. If you committed the crime, then you should do the time.
Well,
there aren't many people who actually get pardons, and they tend to be pretty privileged people. So is that fair?
What if they're innocent, though? What if they're innocent? Pardons are all about that.
Good morning. It's Monday, July 28th, and we have the latest headlines for you at this hour. Femi Okeh's here. Femi.
Hi there. 12 minutes to the hour. Three suicide attacks targeting Shia Muslims on a pilgrimage in Baghdad killed 28 and wounded more than 90. Just hours after two deadly bomb attacks in Istanbul, a Turkish court has begun deliberations on whether the ruling AK party should be closed down for becoming the focus of pro-Islamist activity. Now, a former Google employee and her husband have unveiled a rival search engine. It's called Koo. The founders say that it'll offer a more comprehensive way to search the internet. And if you were trying to search it like myself just a few moments ago, try this spelling, C-U-I-L. If you look for C-O-O-L, you'll come up with lots of things, but not the new search engine. Carlos Sastre became the third Spaniard in a row to win the Tour de France yesterday. His victory was muted a little bit by news that a Kazakh rider tested positive for a banned stimulant. It was the fourth doping bust of this year's tour. And finally, a collection of African aid agencies criticized the Joint African Union and the UN peacekeeping mission in Darfur region of Sudan. They said the mission had been underway for 6 months and still only one-third of personnel had been deployed.
People in Darfur who we work with have been asking for protection for the last 5 years since the crisis started, really. You know, for the world to promise this force and then not even give it the troops and the equipment and the basic support that it needs is really quite a shameful failure.
And that's Alan MacDonald, who's working with the aid agency Oxfam in Darfur. Now, the head of the UN peace mission in Darfur, Sudan, says that trying to deploy just 8,000 people that he has right now is a bit like trying to police an area the size of France with 8,000 troops. Just can't be done.
One little thing, Femi. Do you think this new search engine is going to help you with your spelling problem? Or what do you think?
If I know how to Google it first, yes.
You know how to Google it first.
I would be there for hours. I'd still be there looking for it.
Our crack investigator, Femi Okeh. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So for 13 years, Radovan Karadzic hid in the Serbian capital of Belgrade, the place where he was perhaps most wanted. The war criminal from the Bosnian-Serb wars and conflict of the 1990s used false documents and false identities to assume the life of a doctor, the kindly Dr. Dabik. So how do you do such a thing? Joining us now is Frank Ahern, who's an independent privacy consultant based in Los Angeles. He's here in the studio. You know, many people saw the pictures of Radovan Karadzic with this kind of Santa Claus-looking beard and the way that he completely transformed his identity from a war criminal, from a political leader, a nationalist leader, to a naturopathic doctor. And, you know, ask the question, you know, could I do the same? Could I drop out? Has the technology for changing your identity improved that this is maybe much more plausible than we might think?
Well, first, thanks for having me. He's a little extreme because he had a lot of means prior to going on the run. I mean, he was a president, so he had the money behind him. He had the ability to get the documents, be a passport. From his point of view, it was very easy to do. But unlike a lot of people who go on the run, especially when they take a new identity, they end up coming out of the woodwork. And here is an extreme character who was president, somewhat of a sociopath, and he tries to become normal. And it just doesn't seem to work. It's like taking a gangster and putting him in the witness protection program. Eventually it comes out. But the average person can pick up, go, and some can actually change their identity. It's doable.
So it's a two-stage process is what you're describing. You have to have the support network to disappear you, and then you have to have make the right choices in terms of technology, perhaps something as extreme as plastic surgery to actually eradicate your previous identity. So it doesn't really work unless you have both.
To a degree, okay? Someone like him, I mean, he had all the means available. Take someone like John Darwin from the UK, who was an average guy, who basically was able to get a new passport and did everything correct. Technology can be an aid.
He faked his death, actually.
Right. Yeah. He faked his death and walks in 5 years later and said he had amnesia. But he, both characters show that the average person can do it and somebody with means can do it as well.
Whitey Bulger comes to mind.
Yeah. There's an amazing, you know, he's an arch criminal and nobody's found him yet, but I don't think they necessarily want to find him. I think he's got a lot of skeletons in the closet there.
Well, if I wanted to, if I basically, you know, said, you know, I got a lot of really awful secrets, I really got to get out of town, I really need to, you know, get rid of this John Hockenberry identity and maybe, you know, come up with something else, like how about Fred Gillespie? What would be the first, like, sort of three or four steps I would take to actually end my identity?
Well, first of all, to get a new identity, one of the problems with that is you don't know whose identity you're buying. You don't know if there's a warrant for their arrest, tax liens. So you don't know the mess that you're getting into. What a lot of people do is start from the basics. They try to get a voter's registration card, a library card, and they start building up on different pieces of identification and start working their way up to eventually a Social Security card or a driver's license or a non-driver's ID. And that's how the criminals pretty much do it. It's just building it up that way.
But isn't that tricky? Because you're always on the verge of being found out for that very reason that you laid out to begin with, which is you don't know what life this Social Security number has lived before you got your hands on it.
Right, exactly. But being a criminal, I guess it's the chance they're willing to take. The clients that I work with are not breaking the law. They don't get new identifications. We work it in a very different aspect. So I guess when you're going on the run, better something than who you are. And that's
how do you trust your neighbors if you're in a fundamentally new place? I mean, I don't know if witness protection program is the best example, but if you suddenly just move in and people say, "Oh, what do you do?" "Oh, I'm just a consultant," you know. I mean, how much do you worry about neighbors actually trying to figure out who you really are?
Well, that's one of the problems. I mean, you do have to be somewhat normal and have the ability to fit in, but that is the problem with the criminals that go into the witness protection program. They're just a total fish out of water. It's like that Steve Martin movie, it was My Blue Heaven or something like that, where you take this individual and you can't be Johnny Miami and pick up and go and be like L.A. Ted and be like this. I tell my clients that, you know, you have to go to something that fits you, something before, but you can't be on the bowling league if you were a big bowler once before. So
is that the most common mistake that people who are trying to hide their identities do, which is they go back to their old habits? Like you're saying, if I'm a big bowler, I go to the new place, I'm a big bowler.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you've ever watched, like, the U.S. Marshals, they always catch the guy going back to his neighborhood. I mean, we're creatures of habit.
I like to waste chumps, you know? I needed to go out and waste some chumps. So, but Frank, sex change operation?
That's a little extreme, you know?
Maybe for you.
That's true. The only one that I ever heard of that really changed his identity was Sammy the Bull. He got some plastic surgery, but look what he's back in prison. I mean, it doesn't do him any good.
What was your name before Frank Ahern?
I can't tell you that.
Come on.
That's always been Frank Ahern. I mean, why would I name myself Frank? You know, I'd go for John.
John. Yeah, John. John, that's a real... Yeah, I've been hiding behind these glasses for a long time.
Yeah, there's just something so exquisite about that, John. Well, exotic.
I mean, should war criminals, people like Radovan Karadzic's of the world, Ratko Mladic, for instance, who is still out there, should they worry about what's happened, that maybe these disguises do have a finite end, or can some people actually feel like, you know what, I'm going to be fine?
I think it depends on who you are. I mean, you can steal $1 million and maybe get away with it. You can't steal $40 million, or, you know, you can't kill 300,000 people and sit tight. You know, the old saying, it all...
That's the takeaway, though. You can steal $1 million and probably get away with it, but 40, well, no.
People are going to look a lot harder for you. I mean, the harsher... Once you're in the sight of law enforcement, they're going to come in and they're going to catch you and pick you up.
Frank Ahern, good advice for all of us. Thank you very much. Independent privacy
consultant.
Don't
take more than $1 million, otherwise you are toast.
Yeah, so my co-host, Madam X here. Yes, today on The Takeaway, the credit crunch continues. So does the presidential campaign. We're also taking a look at the lives of reporters who are covering the trials at Gitmo.
The tough task of stopping Afghanistan's pop trade. You know what? Let me just say this one thing. I clerked for a federal judge, and somebody stole a $500,000 check from Bank of America and then deposited it. Did you think Bank of America might be looking for? Of course they were anyway. That person was arrested and convicted.
That's
now, we're
not
also looking at
ways.
I know, they didn't change their identity. Yeah. And sometimes my judge told me sometimes we lock up people.
Forgot to change my identity.
For being dumb.
Yeah.
And that's what it was there. Anyhow, take a look at how people disappear. And it's that time again, presidential pardons, as John is saying. Who's asking for them? Who may get them? And who would you want to pardon? Our listener, Larry, this is what he said.
With regard to the pardoning issue, there was a six-hour House Judiciary Committee meeting last Friday where huge amounts of evidence was presented whereby the president could easily be impeached. Therefore, it would seem easy to see that President Bush will try to pardon himself, if that's at all possible.
Hmm.
Thanks for that, Larry. We want you to weigh in at 8778-MYTAKE, or you can email us at www.thetakeaway.org.
Yes, you heard it first here. President will pardon himself. We're always on here at The Takeaway. You can find us online, streaming on Friend Feed, on Facebook. Come around to thetakeaway.org. There's plenty to do. You can visit. It's Monday. Have a great week. I'm John Hockenberry.
It takes on new meaning today that we're always on.
Yeah, well, for 4 hours.
Four hours.
Yeah, but we are always
That's
on.
Always. Four
we're
hours always equal on. Always to always me. I'm Adora Udogie, and this is The Takeaway.